That fall, the CIA's counter-terrorist center grew chaotically to about 2,000 full-time personnel. Its Office of Terrorism Analysis alone ballooned from 25 to 300. The office annexed entire groups of regional and subject matter experts from the mainstream Directorate of Intelligence. You were following Polish politics yesterday. Today you are analyzing terrorism issues in Central Asia. For a few weeks, Kofor Black slept on a blow-up mattress in his office, and some of his deputies slept on cots. Conference rooms became group offices with analysts and reports officers shoulder to shoulder. Computer wires spread like kudzu. Tenet ordered any Directorate of Operations personnel whose skills were tangentially related to terrorism, narcotics teams, illicit finance units, to be folded under Kofor Black's authority. Tenet thought Black was an enormously talented leader and trusted him deeply. In some sections of the agency, Black's language and manner rubbed people the wrong way. The Directorate of Operations was a professional shark tank. You have big personalities, and everybody wants to drive the car, as one senior official put it. Black was trampling all over the CIA's organization chart that autumn, grabbing and dispatching talent, upending careers and prerogatives, not asking permission to have his officers travel across other divisions' turf. The traditional area chiefs, senior intelligence service officers in charge of Latin America, Europe, or Asia, resisted surrendering their personnel to CTC, at least not without some kind of bureaucratic due process. The feeling among Black and his colleagues down at CTC was, essentially, is it not obvious that we should put all hands on deck to prevent a second-wave Al-Qaeda attack on American soil? Are you really going to waste our time on these personnel issues? Black worked to control himself and not fight, only because fighting was unproductive. Yet fights went on just about every day. At one meeting that became legendary at CTC, an area division manager asked whether the new terrorism-centric order at CIA would affect flex time, a program that allowed employees to work at home some days. The prevailing assumption inside the counter-terrorist center was that bin Laden probably had additional attackers already in place. Threat reporting about possible follow-on Al-Qaeda operations was off the charts. Partly this was a distortion caused by the CIA and the National Security Agency increasing the fidelity on their collection. Both agencies suddenly solicited and listened for every scrap of information about Al-Qaeda that might be obtained worldwide. At CTC's urging, Allied intelligence services from Jordan to Egypt to France to Malaysia detained Islamist suspects on whatever pretense was available and interrogated them for clues about Al-Qaeda's next plot. Black, Bin Bonk, and other CTC leaders flew to Libya, Pakistan, Jordan, Russia, Britain, and elsewhere to ask counterparts for every scrap of relevant information they might possess. They heard scary reports, some vetted, some not. But nobody wanted to be blindsided again. And the CIA's leadership feared that the agency's very existence would be at stake if they missed a big attack a second time. They were thoroughly convinced that there would be another attack inside the United States soon, and that it would be even more spectacular than September 11th. The panic gripping Washington that autumn had some basis in hard evidence. On September 18th, the first of a series of mysterious envelopes containing lethal anthrax spores were mailed to two Democratic senators on Capitol Hill and to the National Enquirer in Florida. The anthrax attack spread to the three major broadcasting networks, ultimately killing five people who inhaled the spores. Nobody knew where the envelopes had originated. The CIA had also learned within weeks after the attacks on New York and Washington that a retired Pakistani nuclear scientist, Sultan Bashiruddin Mahmud, and a retired nuclear engineer, Chaudhry Majid, had met with bin Laden in Afghanistan. They had discussed sharing materials for weapons of mass destruction. It appeared that these contacts with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda may have been supported, if not facilitated, by elements within the Pakistani military and intelligence establishment, as Tenet put it. The CIA's analysts judged that Al-Qaeda wanted chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, not as a deterrent, but to cause mass casualties in the United States. ISI detained Mahmoud and allowed the CIA to interrogate and polygraph him. When the scientist discussed his time in Afghanistan, the polygraph operator reported that Mahmoud's answers showed deception indicated. The Counterterrorist Center was thrust into an unusual position within the American national security state. It was a locus of government expertise about a poorly understood enemy. It was also the only institution in town that possessed the outline of a war plan to enter into Afghanistan quickly. At the Pentagon, there were no plans on the shelf that had been previously vetted by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Afghanistan was not well understood by the Pentagon's high command. The relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban was a mystery. The feeling among the chiefs of the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines, as a general involved put it, was, "Where is Afghanistan? Where are the maps?" The fact was that there was no existing war plan for Afghanistan, Rumsfeld admitted. In some cases, our analysts were working with decades-old British maps. The CIA was in a better position to influence the White House. 4 days after the Al-Qaeda attacks, Tenet presented a slide deck entitled "Going to War" to President Bush and his National Security Cabinet. Rich Blee and Ben Bonk at CTC had prepared the slides. They were adapted from memos composed months earlier in response to periodic requests from Richard Clark at the White House for blue-sky thinking about what CIA would do to attack Al-Qaeda if the agency could spend more money and felt no political constraints. The earlier memos had not been acted upon, but they covered substantial ground, such as how to arm and support Massoud's guerrilla forces and how to identify more aggressive anti-Taliban allies in southern Afghanistan. The slide deck contemplated a light footprint campaign in Afghanistan that would start quickly with Massoud's forces in the Panjshir and spread to include other anti-Taliban groups led by Afghan Mujahideen known to the CIA from the 1980s. These warlords included the ethnic Uzbek commander Abdul Rashid Dostum, a former communist general who had spent years in exile in Turkey, Adam Muhammad Nur, an ethnic Tajik commander allied with Ahmad Shah Massoud, and Ismail Khan, a former CIA client who had been expelled by the Taliban from his stronghold in the western city of Herat. These were the most powerful men under arms who were implacably opposed to the Taliban. They had regional followings and could be used to stabilize and even rule Afghanistan after the Taliban were expelled from office. The plan embedded in the "going to war" slides offered speed to Bush and his cabinet. A second attraction was that a light, mobile force of guerrilla advisors with laser-targeting equipment could bring to bear America's precision air power while minimizing U.S. casualties. Operation Enduring Freedom, the ensuing Afghan campaign by small special forces teams, aided by CIA paramilitaries and case officers, some riding on horseback, would later be well chronicled in books, memoirs, and military lessons learned reports. The CIA started out in the leading role and transitioned slowly to a more familiar mission of collecting target intelligence, chasing Al-Qaeda fugitives, and running off-the-books militia operations. The CIA's first northern Afghanistan liaison team, led by Gary Schroen, landed by helicopter in the Panjshir Valley on September 26th. Schroen was a Dari speaker in his early 60s, the equivalent within the CIA's ranks of a three-star general. He had served several tours in Pakistan and had worked with Ahmad Shah Massoud and his aides for more than a decade. It would take weeks for Pentagon Special Forces units to join the fight. On October 17th, Rumsfeld wrote a biting memo to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Air Force General Richard Myers. General Hugh Shelton had already been scheduled to retire when September 11th took place. "Given the nature of our world, isn't it conceivable that the department ought not to be in a position of near total dependence on CIA in situations such as this?" Rumsfeld asked. Black put Hank Crumpton in charge of the counter-terrorist center's part of the war. Crumpton had been CTC operations chief until the summer of 2001, when he rotated to become chief of station in Canberra, Australia. He returned to new headquarters to work out of a windowless room filled with maps, photos, books, and stacks of paper. It looked like the office of an associate professor at a small, poorly funded liberal arts school. Once Crumpton arrived, Blee and his operations officer took charge of Al-Qaeda missions outside Afghanistan. Their work was folded under a massive covert action program, perhaps the largest in CIA history, under the code name of Greystone. As new officers poured into CTC, they organized two new units to track Al-Qaeda's finances and experiments with chemical, biological, and nuclear materials. Kofor Black traveled abroad frequently, but when he was at Langley, he tried to buck up his workforce. Many case officers and retirees felt fired by an attitude of war-fighting volunteerism. Black sent Billy Waugh, a legendary street operative he had worked with in Sudan, forward to Afghanistan, where Waugh celebrated his 73rd birthday. Yet some of the Counter-Terrorist Center's analysts, desk-bound and responsible for finding terrorist needles in overnight cable haystacks, also felt pressured. Some felt guilt and embarrassment, and heard even agency colleagues say that September 11th was their fault. "We were all angry, of course," as an officer then at CTC put it. At the same time, a kind of guilt feeling comes across. You feel like maybe you let people down, maybe you let the country down, because you couldn't prevent it from happening. You're at the pointy end of the spear in the Counter-Terrorist Center. You would like to have thought you could prevent something like this from happening. It was inevitable that CTC would take arrows, Black told colleagues. When the hearings and the retribution and the finger-pointing comes, we are going to get hammered. They should do what they could, without self-pity, in the time available, before their careers ended, his most ingloriously of all, he said. In the Panjshir Valley, to support the Northern Alliance's drive on Kabul and the search for Al-Qaeda leaders, Gary Schroen's team set up a joint intelligence cell with Amrullah Saleh and engineer Arif. With Massoud dead and the CIA on the scene, the two Northern Alliance intelligence leaders moved into critical positions, supporting the CIA officers, but also trying to keep track of what they were doing. Schroen's men had carried in $10 million in boxed cash. They handed out bundles like candy on Halloween. Schroen had recruited onto his team Chris Wood, the Dari-speaking case officer who had worked the Taliban account out of Islamabad. Wood ran the day-to-day intelligence reporting at the joint cell, collecting and synthesizing field radio reports about Taliban and Al-Qaeda positions and movements. Fahim Khan, Massoud's military chief, commanded the Panjshiris war. His deputy on the front line was Bismillah Khan, whose men controlled the mouth of the Panjshir, facing the Somali plains. Beyond those plains lay Kabul. To the east, the Northern Alliance line was manned by about 2,000 fighters loyal to Abdul Rasul Sayaf, a conservative Mujahideen leader from the anti-Soviet war who had once been close to bin Laden. Schroen visited Sayaf early on and gave him $100,000 in cash. Sayaf's men showed the CIA team the shadow of an old airstrip near their section of the front line. Vacationing German trout fishermen had used the strip before the Second World War, some locals explained. Others said the owners of a German brewery had used it. Reading a history of Britain's wars in Afghanistan, one of Schroen's team eventually discovered that the German military had constructed the field around the time of the First World War. Now it consisted of barely visible ruts. Schroen suggested to Chris Wood that they hire local men to dig out the field and make it operational. Wood became foreman. Every few days he rolled over to the construction site to check on progress and distribute a cash payroll. He by now sported a full blonde beard. Whenever he got out of his SUV, his Panjshiri security detail followed him, toting assault rifles. One mid-October afternoon, a CIA colleague at their main Panjshir base interrupted Schroen. The colleague was on the secure phone to Langley. "This is the mission manager for Predator flights," the officer explained. "He wants to know if we have any information about a newly constructed airfield on the Somali plains near a village named Gul Bahar." Schroen took the phone. "Sir, we have a Predator loitering above what appears to be a newly constructed Taliban airfield. the voice on the other end reported. CIA confirms this is a new Taliban facility, under construction for the past 10 days or so. The Predator is looking at an SUV parked on the dirt landing strip, and there are two men dressed in Western-style clothing. We think they may be Al-Qaeda. Schroen assured the caller he was wrong. They were tilting their Hellfire at two CIA officers, including Chris Wood. The caller asked if he was sure, and Schroen assured him that he was positive. He had forwarded reports on the airstrip's construction to CIA headquarters, including geo-coordinates, several times. Schroen was incredulous. He could understand how the U.S. military might not know about his clandestine airstrip project, but how could the CIA not know about it? Had the officer on duty not thought to call the Panjshir base to check, the Predator might have killed his colleagues. In years to come, Wood would rise in the senior intelligence service to become one of the CIA's most influential officers in the long Afghan war, serving multiple tours as station chief in Kabul and as an intelligence liaison to the Obama administration's National Security Council during a critical period of war planning. Wood later led the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, as it would be renamed in 2004, where he commanded the agency's worldwide drone operations. The CIA's center was an internal unit, distinct from the Interagency National Counterterrorism Center, which was created as part of a 2004 intelligence reorganization. Wood had more reason than most to understand that not every tall, bearded man surrounded by bodyguards was what he seemed to be. Back at Langley, operations that would come to change the character of global air war, lethal drone flights conducted by remote control from far away, evolved from the confusion of October 7th toward a steady tempo. In the Global Response Center, civilian intelligence officers who lived in tract homes and townhouses and had never killed anyone followed and watched presumed militants on their screens. They heard the targets' deaths ordered by a colleague in a suit and tie. They watched the victims be consumed in balls of fire. It was hard to ignore the strangeness of this kind of warfare, the way it severed death and experience. One day, an armed Predator tracked three Hilux trucks carrying fighters as they moved through Jalalabad. The CIA officers on duty noted that, to avoid civilian deaths, they would have to wait for the trucks to clear out of the city and move into open territory before they took a Hellfire shot. As the CIA officers watched the trucks, they spotted a large dog in the back of one of them. They talked disconcertedly about the possibility that they might have to kill the dog while attacking the guerrillas. Then the trucks stopped briefly, and the dog decided he had better things to do and jumped out. Cheers erupted in the CIA's Global Response Center. After the wave of emotion subsided, at least one officer in the room thought to himself, "That was weird." The CIA officers named the dog Lucky. It turned out to be not an unusual nickname for other Afghan and Pakistani dogs at the sites of drone-launched Hellfire strikes. The animal's hearing was so acute that they sometimes seemed to detect predators overhead or picked up the whine of missile launches when humans could not, and then got out of the way. In Virginia, one weekend afternoon, while watching one of his kids' football games, Rick Prado took out a yellow legal pad and sketched out a plan for a roving clandestine team that would hop around the world and photograph and document Al-Qaeda network members, much as counter-terrorist center contractors already did. Prado was the most dangerous-looking senior officer working in the CTC that fall. He served as one of Black's key deputies. He was a Cuban-born fourth-degree black belt in martial arts, who had run paramilitary operations with the Contras in Honduras during the 1980s. He was a trained expert in parachuting, knife fighting, evasive driving, and extreme motorcycle tactics. He was about 5'7" tall, then in his early 50s, with a tattoo on one of his biceps. Prado's field experience in Honduras, Costa Rica, Peru, Alex Station, and Sudan had included close photographic surveillance operations against diverse targets. In Sudan, Prado wore elaborate masks that made him look like a black African and drove around Khartoum in a battered car, watching Al-Qaeda and other targets. Prado had come to believe, he told Black, that there was little point in concentrating counterterrorism operations on low-level Al-Qaeda shooters and street operatives. Those foot soldiers would always be replaced. Targeting Al-Qaeda leaders was obviously the highest priority, but the leaders would always be hard to locate. The plan Prado now proposed would aim at upper-middle facilitators, as they were called in government jargon, meaning money traders, weapons suppliers, imams offering safe transit, forgers, bomb makers, counterfeiters, and the like. After conducting close surveillance and building a case file, Prado's team would develop options for taking the targeted individuals off the street. One option would be to turn the file over to local police if it seemed likely they would make an arrest. Another option might be non-lethal CIA dirty tricks, such as planting bomb-making material in a target's trunk and then tipping off the local police anonymously. Prado also recommended that they develop the capacity to assassinate the target. Black approved Prado's plan, withholding final judgment about what to do if a target was fully documented and involved in violence. That fall, Prado and Jose Rodriguez, an old colleague from the Latin America division, who had recently joined CTC as chief operating officer, briefed the concept in the White House Situation Room. Rodriguez had no prior experience with Al-Qaeda, but he was a well-known figure in the senior intelligence service, a hardliner willing to back risky operations. The CIA officers flashed photos of two potential targets, Mahmoud Akazanli, a Syrian in Germany, who the CIA believed was culpable for planning September 11th, and Abdul Qadir Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear program. Vice President Cheney approved the program, which Prado would lead until 2004. It took some effort for Prado to persuade Black to let him back on the streets. He was now in the senior intelligence service, the equivalent of ambassador or general. He had started as a GS-7 at a pay scale comparable to a truck driver's. Most of the targets Prado's unit watched and documented were suspected Al-Qaeda types, but CTC's Hezbollah unit also nominated a few candidates for investigation. In the end, the CIA's leadership declined to order any targets killed, but what other actions might have been taken remains unclear. This was a need-to-know campaign. Only the more seasoned among them reflected at the time that immunity from public scrutiny would not last long. George W. Bush knew the war would bring death and sorrow, but he took comfort from his conviction that we were acting out of necessity and self-defense, not revenge. On the front lines, inevitably, there was blood in the mouth. CIA officers had not fought on such a violent battlefield as Afghanistan since the 1980s. The agency had not planned assassinations since the early 1970s. Hank Crumpton, the agency's war commander, worked from day to day that fall in a barely bounded rage. He felt a burning need for retribution rooted in a sense of shameful violation. Chapter 5. Catastrophic Success. Pervez Musharraf forced ISI Director General Mahmoud Ahmed to retire about 2 hours before the American war began. He did not explain his decision. As to the way ahead, Musharraf told the Americans what they wanted to hear. He was going to clean up ISI. He appointed Lieutenant General Ehsan Ul Haq as his new spy chief. Haq was a clean-shaven Pashtun air defense officer in the Musharraf mold, a professional soldier and nationalist who gave off a rogue's air. He stood about 5 feet 8 inches tall and wore dapper Western suits. His baritone voice carried British inflections. He had previously served as Director General of Military Intelligence and most recently as Commander of the 11th Corps, headquartered in Peshawar. In meetings with American counterparts that autumn, Haq denounced India and pleaded that Pakistan had little influence over the Taliban. As to Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, he emphasized, "It's in Pakistan's interest to resolve the present situation quickly." The Bush administration had demanded that Pakistan prevent its citizens from traveling to Afghanistan to fight against the United States. But it was clear by mid-October that more than 10,000 Pakistanis had gone across anyway. Ehsan ul Haq denied in meetings with Dave Smith that anything like thousands of Pakistanis had joined the war. He made it clear that Pakistan would turn over all Arabs and other foreign radicals to the United States, but that it would absolutely not cooperate in the capture of Pakistani citizens. There were maybe hundreds of Pakistani volunteers fighting with the Taliban in any event, Haq estimated. Smith noted in silence that the ISI chief was off by a few decimal points. Dave Smith continued to ride to ISI headquarters as often as the service would have him. One of his objectives was to probe what Musharraf meant about his supposed reform campaign inside ISI. The Americans wanted Haq and Musharraf to come clean about the presence of its officers and agents on the battlefield in Afghanistan, so the Pentagon could understand more precisely what it was up against. How many Pakistani officers were there embedded with the Taliban? What was the Taliban order of battle? Engineer Arif and Amrullah Saleh of the Northern Alliance's intelligence wing reported that hundreds of disguised Pakistani military officers had maneuvered and fought with Taliban and Al-Qaeda units before September 11th. European and United Nations intelligence officers working out of Kabul never found evidence of that scale of direct Pakistani participation. They typically encountered 2 to 4 ISI advisors in plain dress when they met Taliban units. The Europeans estimated that ISI advisors inside Afghanistan numbered about 100. Mahmoud Ahmed insisted that ISI never had so many officers inside Afghanistan. That autumn, Javed Alam, the 2-star general in charge of ISI's Directorate of Analysis, told Smith that there had only ever been 9 ISI officers working inside Afghanistan. These officers had withdrawn, he added. Smith did not believe the number had been so low, but there was no way to document a precise figure. Neither American nor Afghan forces captured active Pakistan Army officers on the battlefield that fall, at least none they could positively identify as such. To avoid additional scrutiny, Smith later learned, ISI moved its covert action cell supporting the Taliban out of the service's Islamabad headquarters to an army camp at Ojri, near Rawalpindi. From the evidence available, it seems most likely that ISI did pull back many of its officers from Afghanistan during the American bombardment, but kept its support for the Taliban viable. There were ample munitions depots inside Afghanistan for all combatants, the legacy of more than 2 decades of covert and overt war. Javed Alam told Smith that most of the Pakistani volunteers who had swarmed into Afghanistan to fight against America had traveled from southern Punjab, an area of the Pakistani heartland that was home to growing numbers of radical Islamists. Most of them died, he said, without evident remorse. They got their just deserts. Alam and his analysts presented scenario forecasts of where the American invasion might leave Afghanistan. If the United States toppled the Taliban and departed quickly, it would leave chaos, as during the early 1990s, Alam predicted. Alternatively, the Bush administration could enable de facto partition of Afghanistan between North and South. In that case, a follow-on American military presence would have to be sizable, 250,000 soldiers, and would need to transition from peacekeeping to peace enforcement. As it turned out, in the longer run, the general was not far off, not least because of ISI's continuing support for the Taliban. In early November, Pakistan mounted one last diplomatic effort to rescue the Taliban from destruction, this time with assistance from Saudi Arabia. Ehsan ul Haq flew secretly to Washington with Prince Saud al-Faisal, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister. They carried a 4-page letter from Musharraf to President Bush that proposed another effort to resolve the Afghan conflict through negotiations with Taliban leaders willing to cooperate against al-Qaeda. British Prime Minister Tony Blair encouraged their initiative, according to Pakistani officials involved, and volunteered to raise Musharraf's concerns privately with Bush. Blair arrived in Washington on November 7th. But when Haq and his Saudi escorts landed soon after, Blair relayed bad news. There was no hope for negotiation, so far as the Bush administration was concerned. The war would go on until the Taliban surrendered unconditionally or were annihilated. CIA frontline officers divided into factions on the ISI question that fall. Some sympathized with Pakistan's position, recognizing that the country had legitimate interests in Afghanistan's future. Others regarded ISI's maneuvering as unacceptable. This played out primarily as a fierce conflict between senior officers at the Counterterrorist Center working with the Northern Alliance and Bob Grenier, station chief in Pakistan. Grenier lamented the aggressive Philistinism of CTC. The conflict had a personal edge. The men involved were senior intelligence service peers, and they felt free to write and speak sharply to and about one another. They belonged to a generation of clandestine service officers who had grown up in a CIA little constrained by Human Resources Department norms about collegiality or inclusivity. Yet, at the heart of their conflict was a genuine dilemma of war strategy. Should the Bush administration encourage the Panjshiri vanguard of the Northern Alliance to seize Kabul, or should it defer to Pakistan's position that it was necessary to delay Kabul's fall so that a more Pashtun-influenced post-Taliban political settlement in Afghanistan could be fashioned, one more aligned with Pakistan's goals? Grenier felt strongly that a seizure of Kabul by the Tajiks and Uzbeks would make an eventual political settlement with the Pashtuns far more difficult. This was Musharraf's position, and that of ISI. Colin Powell held the same outlook. Richard Armitage and George Tenet were also sympathetic to Grenier's analysis. Tenet thought it was not an either-or question. Let all the options play out. His logic was, the enemy is Al-Qaeda. We need Pakistan's army and ISI to dismantle Al-Qaeda. And Pakistan's stability and interests are at least as important to the United States as Afghanistan's recovery from Taliban rule. Tenet had met regularly with ISI before September 11th, and seemed never to have encountered an intelligence liaison relationship he didn't value. For the CIA, keeping ISI on side offered the opportunity to recruit agents from the service's ranks who might be well informed about Al-Qaeda and allied militants. The Counterterrorist Center assumed that if anyone was likely to have a line on the whereabouts of bin Laden, his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Mullah Omar, and other targeted leaders, it would be officers inside ISI's Directorate S. They had to stay close to the service in order to identify, assess, and recruit ISI informers. More broadly, this line of thinking went, Pakistan might be an imperfect ally, but it had more than five times Afghanistan's population, nuclear weapons, Middle Eastern networks, and a history of alliance with the United States. Because the objective of the war was to destroy Al-Qaeda, not to manage post-Taliban Afghan politics as a neo-imperial power, surely the United States could afford to take account of Pakistan's interests. This outlook did require credulity about ISI's potential as a good enough partner in post-war Afghanistan, notwithstanding the service's long record as an incubator and enabler of extremism. In one top-secret cable, Grenier wrote, as a CIA colleague later summarized his argument, the new, more moderate leadership at ISI under Ehsan ul Haq was now motivated to cooperate fully with the CIA in the war on terrorism. Moreover, ISI had years of experience in dealing with the Afghan situation and were already working hard to build a broad ethnic Afghan government in exile in Peshawar. The Bush administration should work closely with the Pakistanis on that effort, concentrate on the South, and go slowly with our bombing. Grenier recommended, this should be primarily a political struggle rather than a military one. Grenier was worried that if the United States came in wholeheartedly on the side of the Northern Alliance, that would only cause Pashtuns to coalesce around the Taliban. He also feared the Northern Alliance militias would carry out a bloodbath in Kabul, which would have the same effect. They were having enough trouble generating a Pashtun uprising against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as it was. Grenier knew he had crawled out on a limb by making these arguments. His views put him firmly at odds with the newly powerful counter-terrorist center. Hank Crumpton and other CTC officers dismissed him as Taliban Bob. Grenier had taken the side of ISI, but Crumpton and his colleagues knew that ISI was not the answer. Grenier was suffering from a case of clientitis, meaning that he had lost his ability to separate his own thinking from that of his partners in the Pakistan Army. Yet Grenier's position remained influential throughout October. Tenet initially overruled CTC's objections in order to give the Pakistanis some time to address the southern question, meaning the establishment of a Pashtun-influenced force that could emerge as an alternative to the Taliban. Tenet and his chief of staff, John Brennan, were impressed by the sophistication and granularity of Grenier's arguments. While pursuing a policy of all options, they thought his case deserved some time. Forward in the Panjshir Valley, Gary Schroen, who had served three tours in Islamabad since the late 1970s, argued the Northern Alliance cause. The key to victory was in the north, he believed, yet Grenier was loudly beating what I thought of as the Pakistani drum song. Grenier was sitting in a comfortable office in Islamabad, which Schroen had previously occupied, with all the technology needed to send in articulate cables to the Bush cabinet, while Schroen was working in primitive conditions with an old computer that took floppy disks. He was struggling to get his points across. Grenier's position was a blueprint for failure and political confusion, Schroen concluded. This push to allow the Pakistanis back into the Afghan game was disturbing and a real mistake. They had their own specific agenda for the country, and it did not track with anything the U.S. government would want to see emerge there in the post-Taliban period. Massoud's intelligence aides and generals knew about the debate within the CIA and the Bush cabinet, and pushed Schroen to resolve it in their favor. They would pursue their own war aims, regardless of where the Americans came down. Schroen and Chris Wood fumed as the weeks passed, and Grenier's arguments seemed to influence Central Command's targeting decisions. The U.S. Air Force bombed and provided close air support for Northern Alliance commanders, who sought to seize the northern cities Mazar-i-Sharif and Kunduz. The fall of those cities to the Northern Alliance presented no political complications, as the majority of the local population was non-Pashtun. Yet the bombing of Taliban positions defending Kabul seemed tepid by comparison. The first night of the air war, it was raining around Kabul. In the Panjshir, Schroen and his colleagues sat on a balcony and watched lights flash in the distance. There were only a few. They blamed the weather, but soon discovered that, in fact, it was a policy edict from Washington. The Bush administration did not actually wish to break the Taliban and Al-Qaeda lines blocking the Northern Alliance from taking Kabul. "This is all the U.S. Air Force can do?" Massoud's lieutenants asked their CIA liaisons. "We'll have to be here forever." The Taliban imposed a night curfew inside Kabul, but otherwise tried to keep up appearances. Taliban bureaucrats went to work at their ministries as usual. Kathy Gannon of the Associated Press, who had been traveling in and out of Afghanistan for almost two decades, arrived in the capital late in October and found residents paying their electricity bills at the telecommunications ministry, even though the ministry itself had no power. Food supplies dwindled. Mullah Muhammad Omar remained in hiding around Kandahar, but his lieutenants to the north, inside Kabul, could see by the second week of November that if they held out too long, they might become trapped. If that happened, they could be slaughtered and imprisoned in large numbers. Just after nightfall on November 12th, in Wazir Akbar Khan, a dozen or so Taliban leaders gathered to discuss a strategic retreat. They decided by consensus to withdraw right away to Wardak province and to move from there toward Kandahar. Convoys of vehicles roared through the dust at night, evacuating to the south and east into the Pashtun heartland. Amrullah Saleh and Engineer Arif picked up the Taliban's radio traffic. They knew that a withdrawal had started. Yet the Panjshiris remained under pressure from the United States to hold back. On November 13th, when the Taliban appeared to have evacuated almost completely from Kabul, CIA headquarters instructed an officer in Panjshir to meet with the Northern Alliance. The officer announced, "There is still concern back in Washington that there will be a wave of revenge killings by your forces if they move into Kabul." He cautioned, "The Pakistanis continue to complain to Washington about what will happen if the Northern Alliance takes Kabul." The Alliance's commanders assured the CIA that there would be no brutality. They added that they were going to Kabul no matter what your NSC decides. The CIA went with them, three officers packed into a sport utility vehicle carrying satellite phones and semi-automatic rifles. On November 14th, around 6 p.m., they rolled past the shuttered American Embassy building, abandoned since early 1989. They soon reached the Ariana Hotel, in the heart of downtown, which Engineer Arif had agreed the CIA could rent as a base of operations. That night, Kabul station informally reopened after a hiatus of just under 13 years. The Panjshiris controlled Afghanistan's capital. Musharraf and ISI had failed to stop them. Back in the 1980s, during the anti-Soviet war, Hamid Karzai was a university student and organizer, the privileged scion of an influential family in Kandahar of the Popalzai tribe. His father, Abdul Ahad Karzai, had sat in the Afghan parliament before the communist takeover. Hamid studied politics at Himachal Pradesh University in India before moving to Peshawar in 1983 to work as an aide to Sibghatullah Mojaddidi, one of the Afghan resistance's more moderate but less influential leaders. Karzai served as a foreign policy advisor, humanitarian aid organizer, and press contact. He was known as a snappy dresser and a well-liked participant in Peshawar's expatriate social scene, which was enlivened by Australian aid workers, Scandinavian nurses, British spies, ISI watchers, unreliable journalists, and mysterious drifters, all of them energized by a liberation war and the smoky atmospherics of a Cold War Casablanca. As the war raged, Karzai saw the front lines, but he thought of himself as a political and social analyst. His sense of politics was informed by the example of his father, who promoted the traditional power of Afghanistan's tribes and the country's royal family, while also supporting modernization. The Soviet war shattered and scattered the Karzais, as it did so many other Afghan families. In a country as poor as Afghanistan was in the 1980s, privilege and a touch of rank such as the Karzais enjoyed did not translate into seven-figure Swiss bank accounts. They were better off than many countrymen, and yet financially insecure. Some of Hamid's brothers went abroad. One of them, Qayyum, opened an Afghan restaurant in Baltimore. Another, Mahmoud, opened fast food outlets in San Francisco and Boston. Only Hamid and his younger brother, Ahmed Wali, settled in South Asia. Hamid Karzai argued that Afghanistan should seek to recover from the Soviet war by restoring tribes and the royal family as symbols of national unity, a strategy that would benefit previously elite Durrani Pashtun families such as his own. In 1988, he published an essay in the academic Central Asian Survey. His modest thesis concerned the extraordinary resilience and persistence of the very deep-rooted traditional beliefs and religious values of the tribes, and indeed of the whole nation. In 1992, Kabul fell to the CIA-backed Mujahideen. Mojaddidi became president briefly. Karzai became a deputy foreign minister. ISI's favorite Islamist guerrilla leader, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, had been named prime minister, but refused to join the new rebel government. Hekmatyar's forces shelled Kabul mercilessly from a base to the south of the capital. The ISI would eventually abandon Hekmatyar in favor of the Taliban, but at the time he was the most important client of Directorate S. Ahmad Shah Massoud was then minister of defense. Fahim Khan and Engineer Arif, his intelligence aides, suspected that Hekmatyar had a secret network of supporters inside Kabul. One day, Arif summoned Karzai for advice about individuals who might be working for Hekmatyar, a senior Afghan official involved recalled. The idea was to share intelligence with Karzai and ask him to do something about it at the foreign ministry, meaning identify and help round up Hekmatyar's sympathizers. But Karzai was nervous, understandably enough, about being interrogated by Panjshiri muscle men. Afterward, Karzai took it upon himself to visit Hekmatyar to try to find a diplomatic solution. When he returned to Kabul, however, Fahim Khan arrested Karzai on suspicion of collaboration with the enemy. The intelligence service abused Karzai in a Kabul cell. Fahim regarded Karzai as a weak figure who could be intimidated, as a Western diplomat who worked closely with both men put it. After a short period of imprisonment, one of Hekmatyar's randomly aimed rockets hit the jail and knocked a hole in the wall, allowing Karzai to escape. He fled to Pakistan. There he expressed support for the Taliban. "I believed in the Taliban when they first appeared," Karzai later conceded. "I gave them $50,000 to help them out, and then handed them a cache of weapons I had hidden near Kandahar. They were good people initially, but the tragedy was that very soon after they were taken over by the ISI. As the years passed, the Taliban's hostility toward the Karzai family changed his thinking again. Hamid Karzai's aging father spoke out against the Taliban. One morning in 1999, assassins on motorbikes gunned him down. After that, Hamid opened contacts with Ahmad Shah Massoud, Fahim's commander. They discussed the possibility of Hamid Karzai's entering Afghanistan to build up a Pashtun-led resistance to the Taliban. Greg Vogel arrived as the CIA's chief of base in Peshawar in 1999. He worked from the U.S. consulate there. He was a man of medium height who had become well known in the Directorate of Operations for his Spartan workouts and his bushy Fu Manchu-style mustache. He looked like he might be a guitarist in a Lynyrd Skynyrd or Allman Brothers revival band. He had grown up in the Deep South and joined the Marine Corps Reconnaissance Force, a branch of the Special Forces. On one early assignment in 1983, he flew into Beirut after Islamic Jihad bombed a Marine barracks there, killing almost 300. Vogel left the Marines after 5 years to become a CIA officer. For the next 20 years, he served mainly in the Special Activities Division, the agency's paramilitary wing. During a tour in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Vogel would ride for an hour on a stationary bike in the morning. At midday, he would move the bike into the peak desert sun and ride for another hour. In the evening, he would swim for a third hour using a device that rendered his legs inert so that he pulled through the water with his arms. Later, Vogel deployed to Africa and the Balkans. As he aged, his hair grayed and his face sank, adding to his battered biker rocker mien. "Easy day," he liked to say in parting. Paramilitary specialists in the CIA were a wary and misunderstood breed who often struggled to be fully accepted by their liberal arts-educated colleagues, as Robert Grenier put it. Vogel was among the few in his tribe who excelled in both intelligence and paramilitary operations. He was profane and had an imaginative sense of humor, yet he also had a rather thin skin and a sensitive soul. According to Crumpton, Vogel could hold a blood grudge. Grenier made the arbitrary decision to assign Vogel to Hamid Karzai. They were not the most likely pair, except that Karzai, too, was a sensitive soul. Grenier insisted that Karzai was in no way a controlled CIA agent, but rather a potential resistance leader in a common cause. After the assassination of Karzai's father, Vogel helped him to sketch out the plans Karzai was considering to enter Afghanistan and link up with the Northern Alliance. ISI caught wind of the planning and served Karzai with an eviction notice late in the summer of 2001. Then came September 11th, which galvanized Karzai. He and Vogel discussed a new possibility, Karzai would move into Afghanistan to stir up a rebellion among tribesmen and allies in the Taliban's heartland, a more direct and risky version of the guerrilla strategy the pair had outlined earlier. A few days before the air war started on October 7th, Vogel called Karzai. "I can't tell you why, but you've got to get inside now," Vogel said. The implication was obvious. The American bombing would start soon. Karzai had to be in position to take territory and rally followers as the Taliban reeled under the coming air assault. Karzai said he had to check with contacts in Kandahar. The next day, he called Vogel back. "I'm going this afternoon," he reported. Unarmed, in the darkness, joined only by three friends, Karzai crossed by motorcycle into Afghanistan. His courage made an impression on Vogel. It was one thing for a trained reconnaissance soldier to ride into the dark. It was another for a political science student with no military experience. Vogel and Grenier pressed to create a joint CIA Special Forces team of the sort that had earlier been inserted into the North, to aid the Panjshiris and their Uzbek and Hazara allies. Those helicopter-borne teams had landed in areas firmly controlled by the indigenous forces they would assist, however. Karzai had melted into vast Taliban country. He had no base of operations, no bodyguard, and no confirmed military allies inside Afghanistan. The idea was that as soon as Karzai had rallied a sufficient number of fighters to hold territory and defend a landing zone, as Grenier described it, Greg Vogel and Pentagon special operators would follow by helicopter. The truth was, we were all making it up as we went along. Karzai initially toured rural Kandahar, hosting delegations and giving speeches, then moved toward Uruzgan's provincial capital of Tarankot. He found modest support. Perhaps a few dozen armed fighters traveled with him. But also ambivalence. Switching sides was an Afghan way of war, but the Taliban had showed no mercy to those who defected, and it wasn't yet clear to locals how this war would turn out. Where were the Americans? Karzai and Vogel stayed in touch by satellite phone and text. Grenier believed that Kofor Black and Hank Crumpton were too slow to support Karzai, and that CTC's failure to supply him as he traveled was beyond scandal. Crumpton was at odds with Grenier over the latter's caution about working with the Northern Alliance, but felt that he ordered a lot of reconnaissance to support Karzai. Between October 30th and November 2nd, Karzai's small band fought off a Taliban force sent to kill him. They barely escaped. "Everyone in the U.S. government supports you," Vogel texted him. "All we ask is that you maintain a continuous heartbeat." The next day, Karzai asked to be rescued. His phone was running out of batteries. Vogel flew on the special operations helicopter that extracted him and a handful of followers. Back in Pakistan, they moved Karzai into an old schoolhouse at a Pakistani airbase in Jacobabad, in southern Sindh province. Karzai gave phone interviews to the BBC and other journalists, pretending to be still inside Afghanistan, until Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld inadvertently blurted out that Karzai was actually in Pakistan. By mid-November, the Pentagon and CIA had organized Team Echo, a paramilitary force drawn from the Army's 5th Special Forces Group, Delta Force, and the CIA. Army Captain Jason Amerine, a West Point graduate, would command the team. Greg Vogel would lead its small CIA contingent. Team Echo flew into Uruzgan on the night of November 14th. At that point, besides Karzai, the only other Pashtun resistance leader the CIA was prepared to back with an embedded military team was Gul Aga Sherzai, a strong man from southern Afghanistan's Barakzai tribe. Karzai and Sherzai were destined to become political rivals whose struggles would shape Afghanistan. It was the CIA's support that gave birth to this competition. Like Karzai's Popalzai tribe, the Barakzai had produced generations of Pashtun elites, particularly through the Mohammadzai sub-tribe. Gul Aga Sherzai was not of the elite, however. His father, Abdul Latif, was a small businessman who had risen during the anti-Soviet war as a commander. exploiting the absenteeism of the Barakzai aristocracy, as two scholars of the family's history put it. In 1989, Abdul Latif's cook murdered him by poison. His son, Gul Aga, flower in Pashto, a name he adopted as a boy, inherited his networks of influence and added Sherzai, the lion's son, to his name. He became governor of Kandahar after the Soviet withdrawal, a powerful figure in the coalition of checkpoint-extorting, neighborhood-menacing commanders the Taliban expelled from power. He went into exile. Sherzai relied on political influence and a ragtag band of tribal militiamen with no organization and few heavy weapons. Through his networks, Sherzai had been gathering intelligence on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for the CIA for more than a year before September 11th. He lived in Quetta, enriched himself through business and espionage, and bided his time. The significance of his position that autumn was that, like the Panjshiris, Gul Aga Sherzai was already a vetted counter-terrorist center partner with a track record of cooperation with the CIA against the Taliban. Sherzai entered Afghanistan from Quetta to Kandahar South a few days after Karzai landed by helicopter. Team Foxtrot, another Pentagon-commanded Special Forces CIA collaboration, joined Sherzai. To prepare, Sherzai's lieutenants met ISI officers in Quetta to receive Pakistani weapons. The service had reluctantly come to play both sides in the war against the Taliban, but few officers had changed their convictions. The ISI officer handing over the guns told Sherzai's men that they were making a serious mistake in trying to overthrow the Taliban, one which they should regret, and one which they should seriously reconsider. In Grenier's judgment, the threat Karzai and Sherzai posed to the Taliban was primarily political, not military. The Taliban had taken power 5 years earlier by persuading entire sections of the Pashtun population to join them without firing a shot. Now the process might work in reverse. The problem was, as Grenier put it, our own understanding of this broad socio-political shift was hazy at best. The decisive battle of Hamid Karzai's improbable campaign took place less than 2 weeks after he returned to Afghanistan in the company of Vogel. A convoy of about 50 armed and highly irregular Taliban vehicles rolled up a highway from Kandahar to attack Karzai outside Tarankat. It looked like a snake slithering out of the pass, in the journalist Eric Blem's description. There seemed to be no end. It just kept coming, its numbers obscured by the dust storm it created as it advanced across the flat desert floor. Karzai's smaller militia carried everything from AK-47s to bolt-action rifles that likely predated World War II. But F-18 fighter bombers obliterated the Taliban trucks before their occupants could dismount, scattering dozens of charred bodies on the plain. The remaining trucks turned and fled. Many more Taliban died under American bombs in retreat. The victory brought yet more local leaders to Karzai's makeshift quarters, where Greg Vogel, who had taught himself some Pashto, was a constant presence. Part bodyguard, part political advisor, and part reporting officer into CIA channels. The political stakes he managed rose by the day. The Northern Alliance held Kabul. Kandahar lay open to Karzai and Sherzai. An interim post-Taliban government was now an urgent requirement, and the Bush administration appointed the diplomat James Dobbins to negotiate one, in partnership with the Algerian-born diplomat Lakhdar Brahimi. The United Nations scheduled a formal conference in Bonn, Germany. En route, Ehsan ul Haq, the ISI chief, and Abdullah Abdullah, the longtime political advisor to Massoud, each volunteered to Dobbins the name of Hamid Karzai as someone who might be an acceptable interim leader of Afghanistan. "We thought, if he's a Pashtun from Kandahar and he's a CIA guy, okay," explained another senior Northern Alliance leader. It was unlikely that there would be many other aspects of Afghan politics on which the ISI, the CIA, and the Northern Alliance would agree. Hamid Karzai's destiny was sealed. As he moved toward Kandahar, Karzai met tribal leaders hoping to pledge themselves to him early. On December 5th, he had just sat